This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents We Should Hang Out Sometime. Embarrassingly, a true story. Written and read by Josh Sundquist.
To true love and to my true love. Prologue. The not-so-distant past. When I was 25 years old, it came to my attention that I had never had a girlfriend. At the time, I was actually under the impression that I was in a relationship, so as you can imagine, this bit of news came as something of a shock. I answered the call outside on the sidewalk. You always remember exactly where you were when you found out your girlfriend has a boyfriend who isn't you. It was my friend Dan. Listen, no one else wanted to be the one to tell you this. All right. I'm really sorry. Okay. Charlotte has a boyfriend. He blurted it out as one continuous word. Right. I mean, I know. I'm her boyfriend. There was a pause. Right? I asked. It's not you. Oh, was all I managed. I half expected him to follow up, it's not you, with, it's me. That being the official phrase of breakup talks. But it wasn't him either. It was some random tool bag she met at her college. I ended the conversation as quickly as I could. Then I stood there on the sidewalk as if I was in one of those time-lapse shots in a movie, cars and people whizzing by on all sides of me. How could she do this to me? Why didn't she at least have the courtesy to call and tell me herself? In retrospect, we had never actually defined the relationship. She had never actually said she was my girlfriend. I had just sort of, you know, assumed she was. As it turned out, my assumption was completely, totally, painfully wrong. I had always wondered how it would feel to have a girlfriend, to know that a certain girl liked me and that I liked her too. But every time I tried to date a girl, something would go wrong. And now, there I was, 25 years old, and I had still never had a girlfriend. Maybe the problem was with me, the package. Maybe girls just weren't attracted to me. Maybe I wasn't funny enough or confident enough. Or maybe it was that I looked different from everyone else. Okay, audiobook listeners, here's our first footnote. I have only 5 of something most people have 10 of. More on this later. Maybe girls didn't want to be seen holding hands with me in public. Didn't want to bring a person who looked like me home to meet their parents. Something had to be wrong with me, though, even if I didn't know what it was. But I wanted to know. I had to know. So after my call with Dan, feeling so fed up with my years of searching and failing to find a girlfriend, I decided to conduct a scientific investigation. See, I have always been pretty good at things like math and science, the realms of rational linear analysis. I figured, as I stood there on the sidewalk, that I could put my analytical skills to work on my problems with girls. I would go back in time and examine the events of my failed relationships through the lens of graphs and charts. Listener, I'm going to pause here and let you know that there is a PDF document attached to your audiobook download where you'll see many graphs and charts that are in the published form of the book, including one at this very spot. Now we will return to our story, where I will read to you. I would then hypothesize and investigate, tracking down the girls I had tried to date and asking them, straight up, what went wrong? Why didn't you like me? Why did you reject me? I would compare their answers to my hypotheses and ultimately draw a conclusion about the reason no one ever wanted to be my girlfriend. If it was something I could change, like an annoying habit or mannerism, I would change it. If it was some permanent physical characteristic or unalterable aspect of my personality, well, at least I would finally know the truth. And maybe the truth, as they say, would set me free. Sarah Stevens. Background. Chapter 1. Sarah Stevens would pick truth. I knew she would. I mean, yeah, sure, there was an outside chance she would pick dare. But since the dares on this particular day were limited by A, the confines of a 15-passenger van, and B, the moral authority of its driver, there wasn't a lot of point to picking dare. Now, generally, when you play Truth or Dare in eighth grade, all the dares end up being some sort of expedition to explore the anatomy of the opposite gender. I dare you to put your hand here or your lips there. But not so much when you're with your church youth group, and not so much when your youth group pastor Joe Slater is driving, and it just so happens that he recently took the youth group to a weekend-long seminar called I Kissed Dating Goodbye, where you learned that you should save physical exploration, including all forms of putting your hand here or your lips there, for marriage. So, in this particular church van environment, picking dare was pointless. If you did, you would end up with something lame, gross, and improvised, like eating a leftover fast food squeeze packet of mayonnaise or whatever. Tony had picked truth. And then he was asked who he liked, which turned out to be some girl from his Christian school who most of us didn't know. It was kind of a letdown, but now his turn was over, and he had picked Sarah Stevens. Sarah, truth or dare? As long as she picked truth, I knew with complete certainty what he would ask her. Tony had my back. Truth. Tony looked at me. We shared a slight nod. We knew what was about to go down. This was it. The big moment. Our chance to see if our theories were correct. If Sarah Stevens liked me the way I liked her. If she had been talking with her best friend about me the way I had been talking with Tony about her. Do you like Josh? Tony asked. Check. Obviously, I couldn't ask her myself, even in a game of truth or dare, because that would be awkward. But I knew Tony would do it for me. I mean, he stuck with me even when I had cancer, and that's about as serious a test a friendship can face. We'd grown up two doors away from each other, Tony and me. I'd always been homeschooled, and he'd always gone to Christian school. So I would spend my days waiting until he got home, when he could come outside and build forts with me. Then, the cancer. I was 9. I had a 50% chance to live. I would go to the hospital for 5 days, then come home for 2 weeks, then go back to the hospital. When I was home, I had hardly any energy. I didn't play outside, and I couldn't build forts or ride bikes or do any of the things Tony and I used to do before I got sick and before my left leg had to be amputated from the hip down. But you know what? Tony didn't care. He would sit inside with me and play computer games or board games or whatever it was that I had the energy to do. That long year of chemotherapy, that's when I first learned that Tony had my back. Everyone at Covenant Presbyterian Church did, really. Even Sarah Stevens, come to think of it. She had been one of 50 kids who bought Covenant Kids for Joshua t-shirts. And when I first started losing my hair to the chemotherapy, Sarah's little brother Jim had been one of 18 boys who gathered in my family's backyard one afternoon and shaved their heads. That's the thing about going to church. There's a bunch of extra rules you have to follow, like about dating. But the upside is that if you get cancer, if your life falls apart, church people will shave their heads and buy t-shirts for you. They will do anything they can to help you. Sarah Stevens glanced at a couple of the girls in the van. They smiled, biting lower lips to suppress giggles. For a moment, I basked in the hope that this meant she was going to say yes. "No," she said, looking at Tony, not at me. I felt a hot, tingly sensation spread over my skin as I slid down a few inches against the bench seat, wishing I could just melt directly into its crusty upholstery. Not only did Sarah Stevens not like me, but she had just said so in front of all 15 passengers in this van. It was a 1-2 knockout punch of rejection plus humiliation. I disengaged from the truth or dare game until its chatter was mere background noise. After you've been shut down in front of everyone, publicly declared to be uncrushworthy by Sarah Stevens, who cares about anything else? So what if someone is gagging on a squeeze packet of mayonnaise? At the retreat center, I set a pair of crutches on the unfinished cement floor, beneath the bunk bed I was sharing with Tony. We were staying in a rustic cabin with 20 bunk beds and a single naked light bulb operated by a hanging string of tiny metal balls. I navigated my way through the maze of bunks to Joe Slater, who was unrolling his sleeping bag on the plastic mattress of a bottom bunk. Joe was in his late 20s, with an intense gaze, a booming laugh, and a V-shaped athletic build, all of which perfectly matched both his name, Joe Slater, and his job description, youth pastor. "Hey, Joe, what are we gonna do next?" For me, not knowing the activity schedule was like living in an environment where the weather could fluctuate by 100 degrees at any moment. I never knew what to wear. "We're going to dinner," he said. "In the dining hall?" "Dinner. Got it. Keep the prosthesis on." Since my leg is amputated all the way up at the hip, my prosthesis includes 3 artificial joints: hip, knee, and ankle, which makes the leg very heavy and cumbersome to wear. There are a lot of amputees who run and play sports with their prosthesis on. These tend to be the amputees who are popularized in the media and thus the sort who come to mind when the average person thinks of the word amputee. But most of these amputee athletes are below-knee amputees, meaning their legs end somewhere between the ankle and the knee. If you are a below-knee amputee, particularly if you are missing only your foot, a prosthesis can allow you to run just as fast as an able-bodied person. Above-knee amputees, though, have a harder time because they don't have the muscles of the quadriceps to propel their knees forward. It is possible to run with an above-knee prosthesis, but it's difficult and certainly not as fast as running with a real human leg. Most difficult of all, though, is the hip disarticulation level, which is what I am. For hip disartics, running on the prosthesis is not possible. The leg simply doesn't swing through fast enough. So for most types of athletic activities, I would take my leg off and either run with my crutches or set my crutches down and hop. I was faster and more agile without the leg. But I was also more self-conscious, and with the crutches, I didn't have my hands free to, say, carry a plate of food, which is why I would wear my leg to the dining hall for dinner, and why I planned to wear it to all non-athletic social activities during the retreat. After dinner, Joe got up and gave the rules for the weekend. The usual. No going into the other gender's cabin, no talking after lights out, no going off anywhere by yourself. Stuff like that. Then Joe told us to open up our Bibles, and he gave a talk, which is youth group speak for a sermon. The usual. No getting distracted by worldly pursuits, no motives except to bring glory to God, no sexual or impure thoughts, stuff like that. He prayed and then announced that we were all meeting by the lake in 10 minutes. Prosthesis still on, I walked over to Joe. "What are we going to do next?" I asked. Joe frowned, not wanting to ruin the surprise. "By the lake?" I persisted. "Don't tell anyone, but it's nighttime, capture the flag." "Cool, thanks." That meant leg off, using crutches, so I'd be able to run. Of course, even with my crutches, I wasn't an especially useful teammate in capture the flag. I couldn't really hold the flag and move at the same time. But at least on crutches, I could run around to make it look like I was participating. The participation would be fake, but what did that matter when the alternative was wearing, you know, a fake leg? That's what it means to be an amputee. You're always putting on a show. Down by the lake, we divided into teams, counting off by ones and twos. I tried to shift in line so I could be on the same team as Sarah Stevens. It worked. Not that I was going to talk to her or anything, not after the bombshell during Truth or Dare, but for some reason it seemed important that we be on the same team, working together to capture the same flag. Chapter 2. On Saturday morning, after a pancake breakfast, I did not have to ask Joe what we were going to do next because he announced it to the group. Hiking at Shenandoah National Park. It was going to be an all-day trip, and we should wear our bathing suits under our hiking clothes. When we loaded into vans for the drive to the hiking trail, something totally insane happened. Sarah Stevens sat beside me. We were so close that one of her two legs and my one leg were almost touching. And it's not like she had to sit beside me. There had been other vans. There had been other rows with available seats in this van. She chose to sit beside me, which made me wonder, what if she liked me after all? Maybe she was lying yesterday in Truth or Dare. I thought about this as I walked along the hiking trail. It really did seem like she liked me. Not only had she sat beside me in the van, but sometimes when I looked at her, like this morning at breakfast or last night during Joe's talk, she was already looking at me. And then we would both look away from each other. The trail eventually led to a waterfall. It was a for real one too, like what you'd see on a postcard, about 100 feet of vertical drop. While the rest of the group was splashing around in the foamy pool underneath, I climbed by myself up a trail so steep you had to grab onto exposed tree roots to keep from slipping. It was tricky because I'd have to let go of my forearm crutch handle for a second, allowing the cuff of the crutch to dangle from my wrist while I grabbed at the root and pulled myself up like on a chin-up bar. At the top, there was a rock the size of a small car that jutted out over the falls. Sitting on it was a guy and a girl, mid-20s, with their arms draped over each other's shoulders, sharing what appeared to be some kind of homemade cigarette. "Hey, kid," the guy said to me. "Hey," I said. "This place is legit, huh?" "Very legitimate, yes." "How old are you?" 13. "You got a girlfriend?" I thought about Sarah Stevens. "No." The guy took a drag on the cigarette. "Let me give you a tip. Once you get yourself a girlfriend," he said, nodding his chin toward the girl he was intertwined with, "bring her right here. Sit on this rock." He winked at me as if I should understand. I didn't, but I nodded anyway. Trust me, he said. You'll be glad you did. Cool, thanks. When we got back to the retreat center that afternoon, I found Joe Slater. What are we going to do next? I said. Showers, then dinner. What about after that? Joe looked away for a second, squinting into the woods. Listen, Josh, sometimes it's best to just go with the flow, to have some faith that God will take care of things. Every moment of your life doesn't need to be planned out in advance. Sometimes the best moments are the spontaneous ones you don't plan for. You get what I'm saying? His words were true in the way that most things printed on greeting cards are true. But I wasn't asking him about the schedule because I had a problem with spontaneity. I was asking because I needed to know whether or not to wear my leg. Only I didn't want to tell Joe because doing so would violate my rules of being an amputee. I had developed these rules during the 3 years since I'd lost my leg. It wasn't like I sat down one day and said, what are some good rules I can write for myself? Instead, they had taken root and sprouted without conscious attention, like weeds in my mind. And they grew in the exact opposite direction of how it feels to be an amputee. They were a correction, or maybe an overcorrection. These were my rules. Number one, never be a burden. And number two, never be different. As Joe and I stood there by the vans in the gravel parking area, wearing t-shirts and semi-wet bathing suits, towels draped over our shoulders, I considered telling him the reason I always wanted to know the schedule. I needed to decide whether to wear my leg or not. But doing so would violate both of my rules. It would make me a burden because if he knew I was making a decision about whether or not to wear a prosthesis based on each activity he planned, it might affect the way he planned the schedule. Instead of thinking, would this be a fun activity for the students? He'd be thinking, I wonder if Josh will want to wear his prosthesis for this game. Or maybe he will already be on his crutches at that point in the day, which would mean we should play this other game instead. And obviously telling him would violate number two as well, because it would identify me as different. I mean, no one else in the youth group was fluctuating their limb count depending on the activity. And yes, I get that I was very different from everyone else. I was visually different, conspicuously different, obviously different. All you had to do was look at me. I was missing a leg. Either I was using crutches and there was no leg there at all, or I was wearing one that didn't quite look right and caused me to limp. So yeah, I was different, and there was nothing I could do about it. But when you're faced with a significantly life-altering negative situation that you can't control, you grasp at the little things that you can control. The little opportunities where you can make choices for yourself. I couldn't choose to get my leg back, no. But I could choose to ask my youth pastor about the schedule without telling him my hip disarticulated leg was the reason I was asking. This is why, instead of explaining all this to Joe, I was just like, yeah, that's probably good advice, but seriously though, what are we doing after dinner? Joe sighed and then smirked. The talent show. The talent show had been announced before the retreat in case people wanted to bring their clarinet or whatever, but no one knew when in the weekend the event would take place. Except, now, for me. Dinner, then talent show. Leg on. Okay, cool, thanks, I said. At the talent show, Joe Slater himself had an act, one where he awarded most likely to style superlatives. He would say someone's name and then make a reference to something funny that had happened at the retreat, like,
most likely to walk into a spider web on the hike, or most likely to snore, and then everyone would laugh and cheer. Josh Sundquist, he read off his list, most likely to ask, what are we gonna do next? He impersonated me using an annoying little kid's voice. I felt a stab of betrayal, like Joe had revealed a secret I'd confided in him. But it was my fault. I had chosen not to tell him why. I was confident he would have happily given me the entire schedule printed on a sheet of paper a week in advance of the retreat if that's what I had wanted. And if he had known, certainly he would not have made a joke about it in the talent show. People will bend over backward to be helpful and accommodating if they know it's about your disability. But I had chosen to keep the reason a secret because it was about my disability. Because I didn't want to be a burden. Because I didn't want to be different. And ironically, this had led to both of my rules being broken. Even though I never told him why I was asking, I had clearly become a burden to Joe. Otherwise, he wouldn't have given me the award. That was the joke here. I had asked so many times that I had become annoying and a burden. And because none of the other students had overheard me asking Joe for the frequent schedule updates, no one actually got the joke, so they didn't laugh at my award like they did the others. My award was met with awkward silence, and then a smattering of applause, which made me feel very different indeed. I stole a peek at Sarah Stevens. She was staring at me. When our eyes met, she looked away. Chapter 3. As far as periods of life go, middle school gets a lot of hate. But there's one really, really good thing about middle school, which is that if someone likes you, there is a 100% chance that you are going to find out, because he or she will tell someone, who will in turn tell someone else, and after 5 more minutes, everyone within a 50-mile radius, including you, will know about it. Unfortunately, gossip travels just as well through the social fabric of a church youth group as it does through a school. As it happens, I found out that Sarah Stevens liked me through instant message. I was talking to Tony, who had heard it via instant message through Sarah's best friend, Eileen Adair. So the information was very close to the source. In fact, it had never progressed beyond the level of best friends, so it was pretty much guaranteed to be true. I replied to Tony with an excessive amount of unnecessary punctuation, like, "Are you serious?" with a bunch of exclamation marks and question marks. Tony was indeed serious. And furthermore, it turned out Sarah Stevens was pretty serious too. At least serious enough that she wanted to go out with me. Yes, you heard that correctly. Sarah Stevens wanted to go out with me. This bit of information, also revealed via Tony, boggled my mind. I stared at the computer screen in disbelief, my face alternating between slack-jawed shock and wide-mouthed grin. Sarah Stevens liked me. She liked me after all. She had lied in Truth or Dare. I was the one she liked. But as amazing as it was, none of it mattered, because I wasn't allowed to date until I was 16 years old. Mom and Dad had always had that rule since I was little. No dating until you're 16. So from the beginning, my interest in Sarah and whether or not she liked me back had been a purely hypothetical exercise. But what if? What if
they would make an exception for Sarah Stevens. Conservative is the very best description of my parents, for that is what they are in every sense of the word. Not just politically and religiously, although that too, but also environmentally. We always had a rotting compost pile of peels and skins and other food scraps in the backyard, which my mom used as fertilizer for her vegetable garden. And economically. Especially economically. For example, let's say there's a mouse living in the kitchen. My mom will set out one of those little disposable wooden mouse traps with a piece of food on it and catch the mouse. But rather than throw the whole mess away, like most people would, my mom removes by hand the bloodied, partially decapitated rodent carcass and then cleans, disinfects, and resets the mouse trap so she can reuse it, rather than throw away the first one with its dangling mouse appendages and spend a dollar, to buy a new one. Both my parents are wireframe skinny. My mom, because she's a raw vegan, and my dad, because he's married to one. As men grow old, the waistline of their pants tends to sink down beneath an expanding gut, or if they stay thin, their pants creep up on their chest. I'm confident that my dad will fall into the second group, eventually turning torsoless, just a gray-haired head and beanpole arms popping out of a pair of wool trousers hiked up to his armpits like a strapless dress. But I digress. The point is that as extremely conservative people, my parents want everything to stay the same. Or, even better, to return to the way things used to be. So, as I learned at a young age, if you need to persuade them of something, one technique is to frame your argument around the idea that you are making a case for these values. I made my opening statement the next Sunday while we were driving home from church in our minivan. Mom and Dad were up front. My 9-year-old brother Matthew was beside me in the way back, and in the middle sat my 5-year-old brother Luke and a car seat containing our newly arrived baby sister, Anna. So, you know how we've always been friends with the Stevens family? I asked my parents. I paused to allow them to mentally confirm that yes, we had indeed always been friends with the Stevenses. In fact, Mom and Dad would no doubt be remembering that the Stevenses had been in our home school group for a year when Mrs. Stevens homeschooled Sarah. And as I said before, Sarah's brother Jim had shaved his head for me when I had cancer. Now he and I were in the same Boy Scout troop. Dad and Mr. Stevens were tennis partners. So obviously this was how things had always been. "Yeah," said Dad, in a tone that said, "I know you're trying to set us up here. I just haven't figured out how yet." "Well, I thought of a great idea to ensure that our families remain close," I said in my best mature young man voice. "What's that?" asked Dad. "I should go out with Sarah."
"Go out with her where?" asked Mom.
"We wouldn't go anywhere," I said. "I mean, we would just be boyfriend-girlfriend."
"You mean like go steady?" asked Dad. "I don't know what that means," I answered.
"It's when you stop dating multiple people and date just one girl," said Dad.
"Why would you be dating multiple people at the same time?" I asked.
"You know, like maybe you take Betty Sue out on Friday and take Barbara out on Saturday, and then you decide you only want to go out with Barbara," he said.
"So you're cheating on Betty Sue?"
No, I said, Dad stammered.
"Then you're cheating on Barbara."
"No, you're dating both of them."
"At the same time?" Do they know about each other? I asked, confused. Yes. No. I mean, maybe they do. It doesn't matter.
Not unless you're going steady with one of them, which means you aren't dating anyone else.
Okay, well, people don't do that anymore, I said. Now you only go out with one person. No one dates more than one person at the same time.
Hmm, said Dad. It was not lost on me that the subject had been changed.
So anyways, can I date Sarah?
We'll have to think about it, said Mom. Her go-to phrase for a soft, kind-hearted no.
All right, well, just so you know, she likes me and wants to go out with me, so if I'm not allowed to go out with her, that might make our friendship with the Stevens family kind of awkward, I said.
The friendship we've always had, I could have added. But, by the way Mom and Dad glanced worriedly at each other, I could tell I'd already scored a direct hit on their conservative fears. In the coming weeks, additional rules and boundaries were set up, quote-unquote, for my protection. No touching other than hugging, which had to be brief, no lingering. No seeing her without adult supervision. Not more than 20 minutes on the phone per day. Yeah, fine, whatever. I agreed to each of their stipulations with all the thought and care I put into reading an update on the iTunes user agreement terms and conditions. It was a big night. One of the biggest of my life. So I chose my very coolest clothes. I wore my light blue suede skater shoes, both of them, one on each foot, because I was wearing my leg. Over the top of said prosthesis, I chose my cool jeans, dark wash with a wide straight cut. I'd bought them at TJ Maxx for $36. A purchase that had required not buying any other clothes for 3.5 months in order to save up, because my parents gave me a thrift store-sized clothing budget of only $10 per month to buy all my clothes. Footnote, whenever I argued that this was not enough money to fill a wardrobe, my parents would respond that if I bought everything at the Salvation Army thrift store on its monthly 99-cent day, I could buy 10 new, well, new to me, items per month. Anyway, a subcommittee composed of Eileen and Tony had arranged for this to be the night. Furthermore, the subcommittee had agreed that Sarah would say yes in response to my question. Even so, I was insanely nervous as I walked up to her before youth group started. Signaling that she had been waiting for this moment and wanted it to be semi-private, Sarah took a few steps away from her group of friends, meeting me halfway across the room. She was wearing her bright red ski jacket and a big smile. I felt the effects of adrenaline as I walked toward her. Real leg, fake leg, real leg, fake leg. The tightness in my chest, the constricted blood vessels, my pulsing heart pumping blood into my flushed cheeks. Hi, I said. We did not hug. In fact, we remained well out of each other's personal space, like strangers talking on the sidewalk at a bus stop. Hi, she said, still smiling. Will you go out with me? I had rehearsed the words enough times that they tumbled out on top of each other in one simultaneous burst. Fortunately, since she had been expecting the question, Sarah was able to decipher my meaning. Her smile broadened, if that was even possible. Yes. I nodded a few times in thoughtful approval. Cool. I gave her a high five, like a handshake sealing a gentleman's agreement. And then I walked away. I want to be clear, though. There was a lot of thinking in between those two sentences, in between the high-fiving and the walking away. I thought, nice, cool, we're going out. So now what? What am I supposed to do now?
hold her hand, talk to her. But what would we talk about? What do girls like to talk about? Makeup? Glitter? I didn't really know. I'd never thought about this part. I had always thought about whether she liked me and whether she would say yes if I asked her out. Never about what would happen if we were actually going out. Ergo, I walked away. Fled the scene. Hit and run. I found Tony. He raised his eyebrows expectantly. She said yes. He gave me a high five. But when youth group started a few minutes later, Sarah had disappeared. Just vanished. Part of me was sad. I had wanted to sit near her, or maybe even in the chair right beside hers during the talk. Let other people wonder if we might be going out. That sort of thing. But a bigger part of me felt wondrously, gloriously relieved. With Sarah gone, I didn't have to worry about talking to her or holding her hand or wondering how I was supposed to behave now that we were going out. It was a lot of pressure, this going out business, and not having to actually interact with my new girlfriend definitely made the having a girlfriend part way easier. The next day, while I was doing my schoolwork at my desk in my room, I thought about Sarah, how she was at school with her friends. I wondered if maybe she was thinking about me, especially now that we were going out. I wonder if she was bragging to her friends. Josh Sundquist asked me out last night. We are totally going out now. I hoped so. That afternoon, I went online and waited for Sarah to sign in. Finally, late in the afternoon, an instant message popped up on my screen. But it wasn't from Sarah. It was from her BFF, Eileen. "Hi, Sarah just wants to be friends," the message said. It knocked the wind out of me. I didn't know what to say in response. Finally, I typed, "Me. Are you breaking up with me?" Sarah's BFF. "Well, Sarah is, but she still wants to be friends." Me. "Why?" Sarah's BFF. "Because she values your friendship." Me. "No, I mean, why is she breaking up with me?" Sarah's BFF. "She thinks going out will hurt your friendship." Me. "Okay, thanks for telling me." I signed off and went into my room and shut the door and cried into my pillow. My first relationship ended after 23 hours, almost before it even began. I was angry and confused and sad. Why hadn't she told me herself? Why did she have her best friend tell me? And why over instant message? She could have at least had the decency to ask her friend to break up with me in person, or through a carefully worded handwritten letter on embossed stationery. An instant message just seemed so casual, so cheap. Like our relationship was a crumb Sarah was wiping off the table with a flick of the back of her hand. She still wanted to be friends? Really? A few weeks later, I deleted my instant messenger account. I was done with chatting online. It was too easy to be someone you're not, to say things you wouldn't otherwise. Like how you liked someone, or how you wanted to break up with them. If you weren't willing to say it to me in person, I didn't want to hear it from you online. After those 23 hours, our families weren't as close as we used to be. Things changed after all. Oops. Sorry, Mom and Dad. And so I was left alone with my questions. Why didn't Sarah give me a chance to prove myself as a boyfriend? And where had she disappeared to at youth group after I asked her out? Hypothesis. Subject behavior, breaking up with me approximately 23 hours after the initial onset of our romantic relationship, suggests that she may not have had romantic feelings toward me to begin with. This would indicate a possible error in the chain of gossip that had led me to believe such feelings existed. Anecdotal evidence does suggest that factual errors may be created when information is passed between BFFs, particularly if said information is shared via online chatting platforms. In fact, there is a direct correlation between the number of times a piece of information has been passed along and the number of factual errors it contains. Interview with subject is required to validate hypothesis. Investigation. Chapter 4. I arrived before Sarah Stevens. It had been more than 10 years since Sarah and I, quote-unquote, went out for 23 hours. I didn't count her as my first girlfriend. If I did, she would be my only girlfriend. And having had one 23-hour girlfriend is much sadder than having had no girlfriends at all. So that's what I told myself. I've never had a girlfriend. If it doesn't last at least one day, it doesn't count. That said, Sarah Stevens was still a significant blip on my romantic radar, and all these years I'd been curious to understand why she broke up with me so fast. So there I was. It was a few days before Christmas. I looked out the windows of Starbucks and saw the snow on the sidewalk. It would be a white Christmas, something you don't see very often in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Sarah and I were both in town visiting our families for the holidays. I had sent her a message on Facebook a few days before about getting coffee. She arrived late, following a string of apologetic text messages about not having a car, her dad having to drive her, and his driving being very slow in the snow. She walked in wearing a beret that suggested, accurately, that she was now an actor living in New York. We hugged, no lingering, of course, ordered drinks, and sat down by the window. We caught up on the facts. She just got cast for a production of Les Mis. What part? Cosette, one of the leads. What was her living situation? Looking for a new roommate on Craigslist. How was it being back home? Reminds her how much nicer people are here in Harrisonburg than in New York. That sort of thing. It was easy to like her, and to see why I liked her back when I was 13. I couldn't really think of a particularly smooth segue, so I began with, it's weird to think we were, you know, sort of, like, together for a little while there in middle school. She laughed. I noticed she had this two-syllable chuckle that was always perched just beneath the surface, ready to jump out at the slightest sign of humor. She said, actually, since I was going to see you today, I went through my old diaries at my parents' house. I found some stuff about you. I had to resist the urge to jump across the table and grab her shoulders and scream, what? I'm in your diary? You read it this morning? Tell me! Instead, I responded with deliberate restraint, one eyebrow cocked in casual curiosity. Interested, but not desperate. Stuff about me, you say? Yeah, like one time we were going to this retreat together and I wrote about it. In my mind. Retreat? Retreat? You wrote about the retreat? Tell me! My mouth said, silence. Nothing. She continued. Anyway, we were in the van, and I guess we were playing Truth or Dare or something. The Truth or Dare game. And someone asked if I liked you, but you were sitting right there, so I lied. What? It was a lie? And I said I didn't like you, even though I totally had a huge crush on you. With this, she burst out laughing, overcome by the humor of this story from her diary. I laughed too. I mean,
What else was I gonna do? How do you react to that?
When it turns out that Sarah definitely liked you after all, that she admits to lying in Truth or Dare.
Wow, that's hilarious, I said. I remember that retreat.
Oh yes, I remember. That was such a long time ago, she said. I took a sip of my green tea.
Yeah, remember how we dated for, like, a day?
She burst out laughing again. Not her two-syllable giggle, but an all-out laugh, as if I had just hit the punchline of a killer joke.
I remember.
She paused, some more laughs bubbling up.
I mainly remember when you asked me out. I think it was at youth group or something, and you were like, will you go out with me? And I was like, yeah. And then you were like, cool. And then you just...
Here she laughed some more, the memory obviously reaching its crescendo.
Walked away. And I was so freaked out. I'd never had a boyfriend before. I was like, oh my gosh, Josh is never going to talk to me again. Now that we're going out, we aren't going to be friends anymore.
I remember you, like, disappeared right after I asked you out.
Oh, yeah. I asked one of the leaders. I think it was Melissa.
She struggled for the last name.
Bruning? I offered.
Yeah, Melissa Bruning came with me to the bathroom, and I just cried the whole rest of the night, and she talked me through it, Sarah said. She was still smiling, amused by the story, even though we were talking about a time when she, it turns out, was crying.
Yes, crying.
Because I asked her out.
That's a bad sign for your dating life right there, if girls burst out crying when you ask them out.
So you were worried we wouldn't be friends anymore?
Well, yeah, she said.
I mean, you literally walked away immediately after asking me out.
It was so awkward.
I figured we probably wouldn't talk at all if we were boyfriend and girlfriend.
You were probably right, I admitted.
So when you walked away like that, I could see that our friendship would be ruined if we dated, so I just...
She seemed to struggle with the words to describe our breakup, as if she was having to dump me right now all over again, and wished she could call on a BFF to come to her rescue.
I don't know.
I threw a line.
No, that makes sense, I said. I was pretty awkward. And as I said it, I thought, probably I still am, judging by the number of girlfriends I've had.
We both were, she said. I didn't recall her ever being awkward. But that's the funny thing about awkwardness. You can never really tell how much of it is in your head and how much of it is real. Because if you ask the other person if it's real, that is, if she feels it too, then it automatically is. Because discussing awkwardness is always, well, awkward. Liza Taylor Smith. Background. Chapter 5. Of all the socially awkward behaviors I exhibited during my transition from homeschool to public school in ninth grade, perhaps the most outrageous was my decision to memorize everyone in the 8th grade yearbook so I could greet all my classmates by name on the first day of school. And of all those faces I memorized, perhaps the one I was most looking forward to acquainting myself with in real life was that of Liza Taylor Smith. In her yearbook photo, she had seductively droopy eyelids that reminded me of old photos I'd seen of Marilyn Monroe. These eyes were counterbalanced by a friendly smile. The smile was warm enough to suggest that, despite her beauty, she would be kind to any member of the male species who might show an interest in her, including even dorky former homeschoolers with one leg. Liza Taylor Smith. I loved how, unlike everyone else, she had not two, but three words in her name, as if
her hotness could not be described by or contained within the confines of a normal name structure.
Was Taylor a second first name? If so, why wasn't it hyphenated, like Liza hyphen Taylor?
So many questions. We would obviously have a lot to talk about when we finally met on the first day of school.
When people think of homeschooling, they often picture a child sitting at a desk in the kitchen, the mother teaching multiplication tables by scribbling numbers on a blackboard magnetized to the refrigerator. There are plenty of approaches to homeschooling, and people homeschool for many different reasons, but ours functioned less like a one-student classroom and more like an independent study. At the start of the school year, Mom would give me my textbooks, one for each subject. She would divide the number of pages by the number of days in the school year, and those would be my daily reading requirements. That was basically it. So I learned to be self-motivated. In elementary school, I would get up at 7 a.m. and not come out of my room for breakfast until I was finished with all my schoolwork for the day. That's why, when I was approaching my first day of public school, my natural inclination was to borrow a yearbook from one of my friends at church and start memorizing the facts. Because that's what I knew how to do. It had always been my approach to school. Read, memorize, repeat. Back in elementary school, during the finish all the work before breakfast days, homeschooling seemed so much better than traditional school. By the time Tony got home at 4 p.m, I'd already been building forts in the bushes for 6 hours. Then I hit middle school, and my friends in the neighborhood started telling me about the glorious adventures they were having at public school. PE class, dances, pretty girls, everywhere. Suddenly, homeschooling didn't seem so fun anymore. Mom and Dad weren't so excited about the idea. Christian school, maybe. But public school? It was a well-known fact among Christian homeschoolers that public schools were bastions of gangs, drugs, teen pregnancy, rap music, pop culture, secular humanism, witchcraft, and body piercings. Mom, Dad, and I would sit around our smooth laminate kitchen table after dinner, arguing about whether I should be allowed to attend public school starting in 9th grade. Joshua, if you go to public school, Dad lowered his voice in case Matthew or Luke was listening from the family room, your English teacher might ask you to read pornographic novels. I was very curious to know what exactly a pornographic novel was, but decided it was better not to ask. And you'll probably be invited to join a gang, he added. In your first week, said Mom. Don't worry, I said. I'll be sure to wait until offers come in from all the gangs before I make my final decision. Mom's face dropped. I'm kidding, I said. Look, I'm not going to join a gang, obviously. They will peer pressure you, said Mom. This I did not doubt. Nor did I doubt that there were gangs or that I would be asked to join one. These were facts that homeschoolers like me took for granted. The Pope is Catholic. Bears poop in the woods. Public school kids are in gangs that deal drugs. But to me, the benefits outweighed those risks. I can resist peer pressure, but in homeschool, I don't have the opportunities I would at regular school. I really think God wants me there. Also, I wanted to go to public school. I wanted to be on the newspaper staff, to attend school dances, to meet hundreds of pretty girls. But for my parents, what God wanted was more important than what I wanted. And God was more difficult to argue with since he wasn't sitting at the table with us. So I played the God card whenever I could. We'll pray more about it, said Dad.
Eventually, after much more prayer, Dad joined my and God's side, and Mom was outvoted.